Good afternoon. This is February 22nd, 2014, and you're listening to The LaRouche Show. My name is Bruce Director, and I will be your host. Today is the real anniversary of our first president's birthday, as opposed to the shopping holiday, which was designed to prop up worthless Wall Street assets that was celebrated earlier this week. Therefore, it's appropriate that on today's show, we discuss the real George Washington and the unique design of physical economy he put in place with his genius of a Treasury Secretary, Alexander Hamilton. This was a system of economy based on physical production, which was founded on the recognition that the only true source of wealth is the creative powers of the human mind. The ideas and implementation of this system by Washington and Hamilton set the United States on a course that, for the first time in human history, created the conditions by which mankind can consciously govern his present by creating his future. Unfortunately, most of the American presidents after Washington were either fools or traitors. Either way, they were effectively puppets of our historic enemy, the Anglo-Dutch Empire. And since John Quincy Adams, any president that sought to reinvigorate the Hamiltonian ideas was either assassinated or died before finishing his term. The worst case being the current catastrophe that followed the British cooked-up impeachment of Bill Clinton that subsequently led to the ending of Glass-Steagall and paved the way for the disastrous 13 years of George W. Bush and Barack Obama's treachery, which has now brought us to the brink of thermonuclear war. LaRouche has begun the countdown to the impeachment and removal of Barack Obama from the presidency, which will finally bring us back from the brink and start us on the road to recovery. In recent writings, LaRouche has laid down the basis for extending the ideas of Washington and Hamilton into the 21st century and beyond, and this depends on a true understanding of physical chemistry. Joining me today to discuss this is Jason Ross. He is the principal author of a new report titled Physical Chemistry, The Gift of Prometheus, which is a special report put out by 21st Century Science and Technology. Welcome, Jason, to this discussion.
Thanks, Bruce.
So, physical chemistry, brink of nuclear war, the future of mankind, economics, Prometheus, how does this all fit together?
Well, it's important to have an idea of where mankind ought to go and of what the big fight's really been. If you look at the situation today, where the situation in Ukraine is putting us right on the brink of thermonuclear war, and ask, why are we here? Why would the British Empire be willing to take that route? Why would they be willing to push something that could extinct the entire human race? You really have to go back to the origin of the fight between empire and development, which is the fight between Prometheus and Zeus.
So tell us, who is Prometheus? I mean, most people might have heard the name in their middle school Greek mythology classes, one of these gods or demigods, but is this really real?
Yeah, it's a real thing. I mean, in terms of who Prometheus was as an actual person, still getting some more research on that. But the fight that's expressed in Aeschylus's play Prometheus Bound is really the best history of this fight between so Prometheus he's actually a Titan. So before the gods of Olympus, like Zeus and the ones we're most familiar with, there was another group of gods known as the Titans, and Zeus overthrew Cronus, the head of the Titans. He became the ruler of everybody. Prometheus had helped him do that, and then Prometheus also did something that really angered Zeus, which was he helped mankind. The first thing he did was he tricked Zeus into accepting, basically Zeus wanted sacrifices. He wanted mankind to, you know, to honor him. And Prometheus helped by giving Zeus two choices. He cut apart an ox, and in one side he put all the muscles and the meat and everything, and he wrapped it in the ox's stomach, and it looked gross. Then he had the bones, which he covered with fat, which looked very appealing. And he told Zeus, pick a pile. What do you want your sacrifice to be? And Zeus ended up getting the bones. He was so angry about that he withheld fire from mankind. He wanted to destroy the human race altogether. And Prometheus stopped that. He saved mankind, and he made us human by giving us, most importantly, fire. So the short version of the story is that Prometheus stole fire from heaven and gave it to man. But it wasn't just fire. It was all the arts. It was all the sciences.
So what was Zeus's reaction to this?
Zeus wasn't very happy about it. So he had Prometheus chained up to a rock with a chest driven, a stake driven through his chest even, you know, bound up in a rocky crag somewhere in the Caucasus. And every day, an eagle representing Zeus would come and eat out Prometheus's liver, which would then regrow every night. And this was the circumstance he found himself in for hundreds of years, as the story goes.
I think it's important to point out for our listeners that in his opening speech to the Sochi Olympics, Russian President Vladimir Putin commented that Sochi, being near the Caucasus, is near the place where Prometheus was chained to a rock, which is quite relevant given that Lyndon LaRouche has been raising this issue as the key issue in world affairs right now.
Right, yeah. Good place for the Olympic flame.
So, all right, so what? How did that end up? Is that the end of the story? Prometheus was chained to a rock, the liver, the eagle picked his liver out, and Zeus reigned forever?
Well, no, there's two ways for the story that goes. One is the actual story itself, and then one's been the history of mankind since then. So, you know, Prometheus was free. The other plays that Aeschylus wrote are lost. But as other Greek historians say, eventually Prometheus and Zeus made up and, you know, settled their differences, which is a very unsatisfactory ending to the story.
You know, be a revisionist history.
Yeah, well, Percy Bysshe Shelley wrote Prometheus Unbound, and in his version of it, there's no reconciliation. But the other ending of it is, I mean, Prometheus was freed by Heracles eventually, who killed the eagle and freed him from his chains. But the other history of it is that it's not over. Because this isn't just past history. This is happening today. So since the fire and the original, you know, what else did Prometheus give? Poetry, astronomy, so people would know what the seasons were, agriculture, using animals to help, the first use of beasts of burden. This all came from Prometheus. But since then, we've seen a real development of what Lyndon LaRouche calls physical chemistry overall. And along the way, all these developments, these steps have been opposed by oligarchical faction in the world that does not want to see development, because the easiest way to keep people under control and maintain your superiority over most people is if you keep them stupid and poor.
Well, just before we go on to the development of mankind, that Prometheus didn't just submit to Zeus until he was freed by Hercules. He actually tormented Zeus. Zeus thought he was tormenting Prometheus, but Prometheus in turn was tormenting Zeus. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how that works?
Well, because while Prometheus is... Another aspect of the story is that Prometheus knows the secret of what will be Zeus's downfall, and he won't tell Zeus. So he's got something over Zeus the whole time. But people come, you know, like a messenger from Zeus is sent to Prometheus saying, look at you, you're such an idiot. Look where you got yourself. You're chained up, you got a liver, your liver being eaten out by an eagle every day. You're pathetic. You really fucked up. You screwed up. You made the wrong decision. Why don't you be a winner and join Zeus instead? And Prometheus said, forget it. You're the slave, not me.
So Prometheus wouldn't fit in with our current Congress in the United States.
No.
Or with most of popular opinion.
No, definitely not.
And what was he? What did he know about Zeus's ultimate downfall? Was there some trick or some mistake Zeus was going to make?
Unfortunately, this is another one where I kind of wish the original Greek story was better and should be improved in its retelling. No, he knew that he knew who was going to overthrow Zeus. I mean, I was sort of hoping that the secret was going to be that Zeus's evil would end up causing his own ruin, but it wasn't quite like that.
Well, but it is inherent in the oligarchical system that if you have a system based on this kind of oligarchical rule in which man, the creative powers of mankind are suppressed, that any such ruler of such a system is ultimately going to be overthrown, because there's always going to be a falling out of thieves.
True.
Right? And there's no reason for... The system is not based on producing a better future. The system is based on perpetuating the past and perpetuating the existing system. And in any existing system, you're going to have what modern physicists call the second law of thermodynamics, or a decay into chaos, basically. And isn't that what we see today with the attempt to try and maintain an imperial system. You know, LaRouche takes it all the way back to Prometheus, to those times, which you certainly can, but even the current imperial system, tracing it from Rome through Venice and into the Dutch-British imperial system, which has always had to deal with this nasty problem of the attempts of mankind to establish a Promethean type of society, most notably the United States. And then you end up with an attempt to try and extend that oligarchical system worldwide, and you end up with the kind of chaos which right now we see in Ukraine, Syria, all over the world, which brings us to the point of thermonuclear war. So anyway, let's get back to what did Prometheus unleash, because here we are with this situation where, as LaRouche has pointed out, this is a guidance for real-world strategy right now. The world strategic situation is not being determined by, you know, what geopoliticians like to talk about, the self-interest of this nation or this person or that person, but by this actual conflict in world history. And the question is, you know, what do we have to do to end this chaos and conflict which Zeus has brought in us? I mean, should mankind just wait for some Hercules to come out and free us, or what do we do?
Well, we got a Hercules already. His name's LaRouche. We got to do what he's saying.
I mean, he has to clean out the Aegean stables in Washington.
Yeah, there's a lot of crap to clean up there.
Starting with the president.
Yeah, he's the biggest piece of crap. Yeah, I mean, in terms of what the future's got to be, I mean, you'd brought up earlier about the entropy of the oligarchical system. And, you know, we see that in the United States and in the transatlantic world, where the economies are getting worse and worse and worse and worse physically. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, the idea of these protests in Ukraine, of all these people wanting to join the EU to go bankrupt, you know, a little bit silly. But the way out of that is, I mean, right now the projects would be NWAPA, at least for North America, and then worldwide, the development of the next level of Promethean fire. I mean, we've gone from fire, from wood, to using charcoal to change what we could do with metallurgy, to coal, which is plentiful and much easier to use than cutting down all the trees in the world. Petroleum, natural gas, nuclear power. Fusion's the next step. Nuclear fusion would be the next step. Using the helium-3 on the moon, which is the ultimate of fuel sources for, at least for space transportation, for electricity, the helium-3 on the moon would be ideal. That's the next step that we have to move towards. I mean, if you don't have a vision of the future, you won't get to a better one. I mean, the idea, there's this weird, crazy economic idea that if everybody just tries to make money without government planning, without any sort of centralized intention, somehow the economy gets better. That hasn't been the history. Things get better when there's an intention to make them better. And we've seen that from the beginning, you know, with the planned out canals and development in the United States, the railroads. We see it in recent history with what Roosevelt did. I mean, the Great Depression didn't fix itself. Look at Europe. It didn't get better on its own.
Now you point to something I think really interesting here, really important that LaRouche always emphasizes, and yet I see it in terms of your use of the words vision and you didn't use the word imagination, but that's the one that comes to mind. I mean, what is this about human beings that can envision a future? I mean, the future hasn't happened yet. So how can you see something? The word vision means it implies sight, right?
Yeah.
How do you see something that hasn't happened?
Well, partly you have to want to make it happen. I mean, that's one big problem. I mean, sometimes you can tell what's going to happen that's bad. But also, I mean, to have a vision of the future, you have to be intending to make it. And that's one of the biggest problems with sort of these armchair approaches to anything, is that unless you're actually involved in it, you're really not going to be able to figure it out. Like, as an economist, you know, LaRouche, he hasn't been an academic economist of saying what he thinks will happen, but not actually getting his hands dirty and trying to make the right thing happen. he's been involved in it. He's been involved in politics as an economist. And he's been right about the economy. Part of that is that it would be impossible to be as right as he has been if you weren't morally committed to making the right thing happen. I mean, imagine a doctor. You said, oh, this guy's an expert on health. He's a great doctor. Say, oh, does he? How do his patients fare? Is he very helpful with them? Say, oh, no, he doesn't see any patients. He just analyzes what he thinks their health will be, but he doesn't help them.
Those are like the doctors who designed Obamacare.
I think so. Yeah, or it's like an economist that isn't engaged. I mean, how could you be an economist without trying to improve things? I mean, you know, unless you've got a moral commitment to do the right thing, you can't really be that intelligent. There's a limit. Because you're not willing to see certain things because you might have to act on them. And if you'd rather not act on those things, then you're going to blind yourself to them. And, you know, Lynn hasn't had that problem.
So this also gets us to what we started with about Hamilton and Washington. They created something completely new, which never existed in the history of mankind. It didn't start with the inauguration of George Washington as president. This was something that was in the making for quite some time. But once they successfully won the revolution and then won the fight for the establishment of the Constitution, they were here at the head of a government and they had to create something completely new, right? A new form of economy. What were the principles that guided them? Or what were they envisioning in to create that kind of future, which we're trying to revive?
Mm. You know, that's interesting. You know, Lynn's been writing a couple papers recently about this. My sense of the theme of it is, at least for me, what I was taking from it was a different image of the good and economy back in Hamilton's time, in part because science wasn't as developed then. So a lot of the examples that Mr. LaRouche uses, like energy flux density, you know, they weren't really, they weren't in the minds of those people in that way. So you read Hamilton's report on manufacturers. When I first read it, I thought, gee, you know, I was a little bit disappointed because I thought, Mr. LaRouche's economics textbook made the point a lot better. But it's also a very different era, you know, back when Hamilton was writing. But what he clearly had was an idea of increasing the productive powers of labor, that the source of economic wealth isn't in the land, as some people said.
Like Thomas Jefferson.
Right. The source of wealth isn't in money. The source of wealth is the human mind and the human race's unique ability to change how we operate in the universe, to change how we react to nature, how we control nature. What do we know how to do? Are we implementing that knowledge? Are we developing our power to shape things? And that's the source of economic wealth, and that economic policy, therefore, had to be around developing and fostering that. So if you have an economic system that is based on money, well, it's not going to work. You have to, in other words, not just noting that, yeah, the source of all economic wealth is people developing new things, but it'll be really nice if that happens. Meanwhile, the economy itself is based on money. Hamilton said, no, we're actually going to direct this economy based on what the real creation of wealth is, the mind. And that's what the credit system lets happen. You're not going to let money control what you're able to do because of a shortage of money.
And when you talk about the mind, what specifically are you talking about? What, I mean, the mind does all kinds of things, right?
Yeah, you're right. Okay, yeah.
The mind, you know, watches movies, I
right,
guess.
Right, right.
Or follows the plot of a grade B movie.
What? Yeah, yeah. Or tries to.
And you're not talking about the brain, right?
No. It's, I mean, what creativity is the key on that. And that means that you're making something, you know, you've got a system of thought at a certain point in time. You know, Lynn uses in his book, The Science of Christian Economy, he talks about it. You've got a whole set of thoughts, a whole theorem lattice of assumptions, principles that people are basing their thought on. You got a whole system of thought. And there are things that are consistent with that system and things that aren't, but there's your system of thought. And then an experiment is performed based on somebody who's got an idea of how it might turn out that overthrows everything that was thought before. I mean, a real breakthrough doesn't just add something to thought. It makes you have to reconsider all of the conclusions you had before. So that shift from a theorem lattice A to a new one, you could call B, that change is creativity. I mean, that's the power of it. So if you look back to, you know, Eratosthenes' measurement of the size of the earth, proving it wasn't flat, Or if you look at, as Kuza discussed this all very explicitly, that when you have contradictory experiences, when things seem to contradict each other, there's always a higher world in which that contradiction doesn't exist. But those contradictions are the way that nature shows us that we're missing something. And when we communicate with each other, those are the ways that we help our people we're talking to realize that they're missing something. Sometimes you can't just tell somebody an idea. You always have to, if it's really a new one, you always have to get them to figure it out themselves. And that means you can provoke, you can tease, you can show what's wrong with their thinking, but fundamentally, they've got to make that idea.
So this quality of creative powers of the human mind actually produces things which didn't exist in the universe before, right? It actually has a physical effect, like what you were ticking off about metallurgy and all the way from burning wood to helium-3.
I mean, there's a lot of things that have physical... Volcanoes have a physical effect. They move, you know, they spit lava out, they move matter around. I mean, human beings, we move more earth than volcanoes do at this point. We're a greater physical force. It's not because... I mean, if we were animals and humans were just, you know, if we were just using our arms and our bodies to, like, move dirt around, you know, we're not going to outpace volcanoes like that. But the power of the mind is like magnetism, gravity, volcanoes, any of these things. It's that it changes what we can do. So, you know, the first creation of metals from ores, that's something astonishing. It's a process, it's a chemical process that doesn't just occur on its own in nature. I mean, you take malachite, which is a green rock, or azurite, which is a blue rock, or taconite or hematite, which are rocks that iron is in. If you look at those rocks, it's sort of like they're rusted forms of those metals. Like iron turns into rust, it doesn't turn back into iron. That's basically a one-way street out there in nature. And the Earth's crust is full of rusted metals. Human beings, we can make the chemical process occur. We can burn the metal with charcoal, which gets it hot. The carbon in the charcoal pulls the oxygen and unrusts it. So something that never happens in nature, we're able to do when we take all this rust out of the crust of the Earth and turn it into metal.
And we make other kinds of, as you point out in your report here, other kinds of metals which don't even exist in nature, like bronze.
Right. Yeah, bronze, you're not going to find bronze just sitting around. You can find gold by itself in nature. You can find copper, like chunks of native copper in nature. You're never going to find bronze. It's a new material, and it's just better than what existed before. Copper is nice. You can beat it into different shapes. You can make a sharp tool out of it. It's kind of tough. But it's not actually that much better than a rock. I mean, if you're cracking flint rocks to make a sharp knife out of flint, your copper knife isn't really any sharper than that rock. But once bronze was made, bronze you could get sharper than copper. Bronze was stronger than copper. Bronze melted at a lower temperature, which meant you could do casting with it easier. It was a superior material that doesn't exist on its own, and it was made by people.
But it existed first as a vision, as an idea in the imaginations of people whose names we probably don't know.
Yeah.
How they did it.
That's a great thing about looking at this prehistoric time, is that we don't know anybody's names. We don't know who did any of these things. But you do know that most people from this time, we have no idea what they did at all. But we know that somebody figured out how to make, or some buddies figured out how to make bronze. That had a lasting effect well beyond their deaths that won't end.
And we know that the capacity they used to figure it out was this capacity we know in ourselves as the human mind. Of course, this brings us up to something LaRouche also emphasizes a lot, which is how do we increase this power in the human mind? And that lies in the province of art. I'm reminded by this discussion, of course, to one of the greatest poems in the English language, Ode on a Grecian Urn by John Keats, who he's viewing this urn in the British Museum, which was made by people he didn't know, and they have certain depiction on the urn pictures, and he asks all these questions which have no answers. You know, who are these people, where they live, what kind of houses did they have, what was their religion, and so forth. He can't answer any of those things, but he does recognize in this that these people are like us, depend... dependent completely on the creative powers of their own minds to create a future.
Mm-hmm.
And so classical art is actually the domain in which man investigates how the mind itself actually works. So we not only envision new states of nature and new materials like bronze and so forth, but we can also envision new states of our own mind.
Right.
Which the artist can do.
Right. And, you know, an art gives an opportunity to do that in a very pure way. Because through the sciences, you see applications of that power of the mind, but they're always specific. It's specific applications of it, you know, specific discoveries that get made. But then with the arts, you can really look at that aspect of the mind and its development very directly. I mean, if you say, what's the subject? I mean, there is a subject, but what's the subject of a Beethoven symphony? It's not as easy to answer that question as it is to say, what's being done with this type of metallurgy? But Beethoven's saying something very specific. He's got a unique point that he's making, and the way it develops shows something, says something about how the mind works. You know, when I hear string quartets, it's like people are talking to each other, and are they morons talking to each other? Are they having an intelligent conversation? Is it going somewhere? Are they listening to each other? Did they develop something as they talked?
Well, you mentioned earlier that in order to envision a future, you actually have to want to do it.
Yeah.
You actually have to want to bring it into existence. So this is another aspect which is tied up in this, which the artist teaches us, right? That how do you want to do something? How do you, you know, why would you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to just sit there and get comfortable having, you know, an eagle pick your liver out? It's, you know, you get used to the pain, I guess, after a while, and or somebody comes along and offers you some medication to to ease the pain, like most people do. Why would you want? How do you summon that passion?
Right.
That you said is essential for being able to envision the future.
Right. I mean, that's the importance of beauty, because, you know, you might look around and say, hey, you know what? I don't think it's really worth doing anything to stop this war from happening. People kind of stink. This culture is not that great. People aren't all that smart. Maybe they're not that caring. You might look around and say, you know what? Is it really worth it? What's
the point?
We hear
that a lot from people, don't we?
Yeah, and it's not a completely unnatural response to the culture that we're in. It's not that weird of a response seeing the society that we're in. And the reason that it makes sense to fight these fights and make these changes isn't to save what's around today. And, you know, it's not like we have to stop thermonuclear war so we can keep having things the way they are today and keep things going. The way things are today stinks. The culture stinks. People don't have an opportunity to live lives that they know will have a lasting value after their death. Starting when you're young. Like, you know, this is LaRouche. That, you know, when Mr. LaRouche was on the Alex Jones show earlier this week, at a certain point, Alex Jones asked him, "Who are you?" And the first thing Lynn said about himself was that he didn't buy into the education he was getting when he was a kid. That he knew there was something wrong with it, and he would not accept it. He wouldn't accept just being told what to think by his teachers. And it made him unpopular, but very right at the same time. So, you know, it's not, we don't want to just keep what we've got today. We've got to create a better culture. And the work that we've been doing with the, through the Schiller Institute, these concerts we've had in memory of John Kennedy, these performances of the Mozart Requiem, I mean, they're just a powerful, powerful example. You get a sense of the dignity and the beauty of the human being with these things. And you say, okay, that's not worth saving, because we don't really have a society based on that yet. You say, but that's worth creating. That's a beautiful thing. I want that to exist.
So this is also part of what Washington and Hamilton conceived of in terms of the organization of our country, which was that you can't that the essential to the development of the nation was the ability to envision the future, and the only way you can ensure that occurs is to inspire people to have that passion to want to make a future.
Right. To improve, to do good.
To do good, and you have to have a certain confidence that your society and the organization of your society will provide that. Of course, the best example we have of that in recent memory is President Kennedy and his mm-hmm. his you know, shocking demand that the United States put a man on the moon, which at the time when he said it, of course, we hadn't even put a man in space, let alone set off a rocket that didn't explode every third one. And yet he audaciously said, we're going to put a man on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to inspire people to envision the future, and which they hadn't thought about, obviously, few of them had. But now it became a national vision that people got pretty passionate about, because we organized, you know, a huge amount of our economy to fulfill this vision, and everybody got pretty excited about it. In fact, when the first man landed on the moon, I think it was the most, something like 80% of the world's population watched that live on television, even in gathered around in little villages
right.
in undeveloped countries. I want to get back to a bunch of these things. Let me just say right now, since we're halfway through, that you're listening to The LaRouche Show with Jason Ross, who is the primary author of a really excellent report put out by 21st Century called Physical Chemistry and The Gift of Prometheus. And we've been discussing the importance of that. Now, I want to go through, I want to get to this stuff that's in the report so we can motivate our readers to look at it. And I guess it's available now at the 21st Century website.
It's almost available. It'll be up. If it's not up by the time this is posted, it will be very soon.
So you can get it when it is available at www.21stcenturyscientetech.com, which is a pretty long web address. But there will be a link to it on the LaRouche Pub website.
Yeah.
On the
EIR
website.
Be.
Okay, mm-hmm. So if you go to the LaRouche Pub website, www.larouchepub.com, there'll be a link to the 21st Century site. So if you can't remember that long URL, you can get it. Or I guess we could put out the IP address, whatever that would be. But
even better, it will be it'll be available on Amazon, too, for purchase.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Okay, so people can get this report, and I hope that after you listen to this, you're going to want to download it and go through it, because it's a very, very excellent report, quite extensive, and has a lot of material in it. Before I get to going through some of the ideas which are in this report, I just want to go back to one thing you said, because you said Hamilton said that the economy was not based on money, but was based on something else. And yet, Hamilton was the organizer of what most people think is the money of the United States, with the National Bank. He founded the National Bank, and he created what most people think is our money system. Is that true?
Well, we do use money, but that doesn't mean it's based on money. I mean, a poet isn't an expert on words. You know, at least hopefully, they're an expert on actually saying things. Or a musician uses notes, but they use it to say something. You know, a speaker uses words, but it's to say something. And Hamilton, yeah, he used money, but it was to do something. So, you know, it's not like he's a grammarian setting up the right way to use a language, like, you know, setting up how to use money. You know, we use money. I mean, having money is definitely a helpful thing for society. You know, what else would we do? Barter and carry around things and trade them with each other? That's silly. So money itself isn't bad, but
What's the difference between Hamilton's concept of money and, you know, what we have today?
What we got today is that that money instead of government is sovereign. So with Hamilton, the nation was sovereign, and the nation wouldn't be ruled in what it could do. It was a sovereign nation. It wasn't controlled by people who happened to have a lot of money. If what those people who happened to have a lot of money, if what they wanted to do wasn't in the best interests of the nation, the way out of that is through a credit system, that the nation's able to have a sovereign control and direction over how credit flows in the nation. I mean, take an example. Roosevelt didn't have a national bank the way Hamilton did, so he had to sort of work around it. But if you say what happened in the New Deal, there wasn't a ton of money sitting around. How did Roosevelt pay for all those New Deal projects?
How did he do it?
Right. Well, he organized credit, and it wasn't in as pure a way as Hamilton did. I mean, I'll say. I mean, it did involve getting private money as well. But it was directed by the nation for specific projects that would improve it. So it's not an abstract system of money will take care of itself. The government has to have an active role. In Hamilton's time, that meant things like canals and roads. But you have to have a mission, and that mission doesn't just come out of the actors in an economy themselves. It should come from the nation, like what you said about Kennedy. I mean, going to the moon, that didn't just happen because aerospace corporations decided to get together and finance it as a great PR thing for themselves. You know, it was a national program, and it was one that didn't cost a dime in the end. It made a lot of money.
So credit, I think we should point out, comes from the Latin word credo, which means to believe. So this gets back to your very first point about envisioning the future. Credit is a belief in a future state which you're going to bring into existence. It's not right. Just a vision of something, but it's an actual commitment to. If you're saying I believe in this, it means you want to make it happen.
Right.
And you actually, so Hamilton's idea of credit is that you have a credit system where you make decisions about long-term projects and where the country's going to go and new states of organization. And that becomes your, that then as it gets introduced into practice actually becomes your money, right? Is your credit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like take NWAPA. That's a program. Obviously, it'll have a huge physical benefit. If you tried to raise money on the markets to build it right now, you'd be unsuccessful. Does that mean it shouldn't happen? That's no good reason to make a decision.
So that's a lot different than what I came with the beginning about how Washington's birthday is now a consumer holiday, which is all based on credit cards. So credit cards is another phony use of word, right? Like war is peace, because credit is not really, credit cards are not really credit. They're actually debt.
Yeah. 1 year, no interest on your new sofa isn't the credit system.
So you believe that somehow you'll get more money as opposed to that you'll create something new. Okay. Let's get to some of these things because that are in this report. And I'm just looking here at the table of contents, which is, itself quite provocative. But, you begin with an overview. I think we've talked about Prometheus. And the next section is about this concept of energy flux density, measuring fire. So this is obviously quite relevant for us today.
Right. It's the first gift that Prometheus, it's the first physical gift that Prometheus describes giving to mankind is fire. And that's an astonishing thing, because Zeus wanted to keep that just for the gods, and Prometheus gave it to man. And fire has changed over the centuries.
Well, but LaRouche also emphasizes, which we should point out, that man is the only creature that actually uses fire. Every other creature on Earth is afraid of fire.
Right, and that's like the definition of how you know that you're looking at a human, at humanity. If you're an archaeologist,
I know when I cook something and it gets a little bit smoky, my little dog wants to get out of the house as fast as possible.
Yeah, other animals, they don't cook their food. They don't set fires to keep themselves warm. It doesn't happen. If a tree gets hit by lightning and it's on fire, animals don't go around it with their marshmallows.
They try to get away from it.
Yeah, those. Yeah. So, but from that original form of fire, using wood, if you look at what the developments have been, just in use of energy, and that section of the report includes a very helpful chart showing the amount of energy use per person over the history of the United States, and also where that power came from. So initially it was wood, burning wood. That was our source of power. And then with the development of the steam engine and the use of coal, the amount of energy used per capita increased dramatically with the later introduction of petroleum for the internal combustion engine. It continued to increase. But through this, this is on page 7 of the report, over the course of the nation's history, up until around the time of the assassination of Kennedy, the last really great president we had, there was a continuous upward trend in power per capita of energy flux density and of energy. And then the last energy source that we introduced was fission. Nuclear fission never really got developed. If you look at the way coal displaced wood and took over as an energy source, if you look at the way oil and natural gas displaced coal in large degree, well, to a significant degree, you would expect, if we were just developing naturally, fission's the natural next thing. Nuclear power is the natural thing to be using. And if we had developed it the way we had these earlier resources, we'd be using, you know, twice as much energy per person in the United States today. If we had an industry, if we had industry that required it, we'd certainly, you know, we would be using it. So with the overall this concept of energy flux density,
well, that there's an interesting distinction too between the previous forms of fire that you talked about, coal, wood, oil, and fission, because the other two are the previous ones are essentially electrochemical processes, whereas right. Nuclear power is not really like fire. You're not combining elements. You're not oxidizing something.
Right. Yeah. It's a completely different kind of power. And we also see with the development of these, you change what you can do with that fire. I mean, wood. You can do a lot of things with wood fire. You can cook. You can stay warm. You can see things. You can work with wood. You can use it for. You can harden stone tools with it. You can't make bronze with wood. Oh, you can. But you have to first turn the wood into charcoal, mm-hmm. which is a higher, more powerful type of fire. So it's not just that it's easier and cheaper to get the same kind of energy. I mean, we do things with electricity today that obviously aren't just replacing a wood fire in the center of our house.
Right.
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 So,
but with nuclear power, with fission power, we're actually harnessing a density of power. Mm-hmm. That is impossible in all these other forms that are involved in chemical processes. Oh,
absolutely. I mean, if you compare the energy, you know, how much energy exists in a pound of wood versus a pound of, you know, diesel fuel, you know, the difference, the diesel's got, you know, 2.5 times as much energy per pound. But then if you compared petroleum to nuclear fuel, the difference is, 10 or 100,000.
Right. Now let's skip ahead.
It's not a doubling.
Actually, to the end of the report, which is where this is taking us, but we'll come back to the middle parts. And it ends with a whole discussion of helium-3 and nuclear power. So what's the next step after fission?
Well, it's fusion, but then even within fusion, so fission is the breaking apart of a large nucleus. So uranium, you know, we get our power from uranium not because it's radioactive. It is a little bit radioactive, but there's very little energy comes out in it being radioactive. The energy comes from being able to cause uranium to break in half, which is different than radioactivity. And by creating a situation where the uranium is breaking in half, and then it lets off little pieces which cause other uraniums to break in half, et cetera, that's controlled fission, and that provides a huge amount of the power in the nucleus rapidly. So that's fission. Fusion is putting together smaller nuclei, basically combining hydrogens to make a helium. The thing is that depending on what fuel you use for fusion, it's not really the effect, what you can do with it, isn't really qualitatively different than fission. So depending on what you're using, the first fusion reactors that people are working on now would use fuel made of deuterium and tritium, two kinds of hydrogen. That would make helium and neutrons. It would make a lot of heat, it would make a lot of energy, but basically it's just going to be making heat. Like right now, a nuclear power plant sounds high-tech. It's using nuclear power, right? Well, what does that nuclear power do? It boils water to run a steam turbine, just like a coal plant.
Right.
No real development in terms of how you're actually getting that energy out of it. So towards the end of this report, the chapter on helium-3, Stealing the Sun's Fire, describes how there's a qualitative improvement in using helium-3 as a fuel source. The reason is that when we use helium-3, the results of the fusion process are all particles that have a charge to them. They're not neutrons. If they've got a charge, we can direct them for, you know, rocket thrust, and we can create electricity directly from them because we've got moving charge particles. That's basically electricity.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a qualitative improvement, not just in the amount of power, you know, per pound, which is much higher with fusion, but also the quality of that power will take a dramatic step upward that we didn't really see with fission.
And I think we should point out that you say that that fission power for power plants and so forth is not radioactivity per se, but it does happen in nature, right? On Earth, uranium atoms do split apart. We concentrate that power in our fission reactors by concentrating the isotopes of uranium that are more susceptible to this process. But fusion doesn't take place on Earth, at least as far as we know, right?
No, it takes place in the sun, but not here at all.
Except in probably very small amounts, although there's a lot of controversy about that. But
right.
But on the levels that we're talking about, we're actually talking about creating a whole new process.
Yeah, we're creating a star.
Creating a star. So we're bringing not just fire down from the heavens, but we're bringing a whole star down from the heavens.
Right, we're bringing the sun here.
We're bringing the sun here. Okay, now, you were talking about metallurgy and with bronze and so forth. You gave us a little bit about that. Why don't you fill us in on that and also the next section on chemistry. LaRouche has made some recent remarks about this question of physical chemistry and that this was not available to Hamilton and Washington in terms of the way we know it. Although I've always thought there's certain aspects of that. Like if you think of the Saugus Ironworks, which at the time was the most industrial, the biggest integrated iron manufacturing facility in the world, and it was in this backwater of Massachusetts. But that was a very interesting chemical process in terms of the way they used this concentrated iron from the found in the bogs in New England, concentrated by little organisms, and then they used the calcium from clamshells and oyster shells to pull out the impurities and so forth. So it was an interesting chemical process. So they had some knowledge of that. But what actually was the advance that we today call physical chemistry, as opposed to sort of just making it happen without really knowing what we're doing?
Right. So first, let's look at the early physical part of that. So if we look at metallurgy, we made new substances. So I talked a little bit earlier about making copper from stones, making bronze from stones, and then the advancement. Well, first off, all of that required a higher form of power. It required charcoal. If you put a copper rock and a wood fire in your fireplace, if you put malachite there, it's not going to turn into copper. Or if it did, it would take a very long time. Instead, we'd create charcoal. So, that charcoal you buy at the grocery store, that came from wood. You take wood and you basically burn it without it much oxygen available to it. So this back in those times would be you take a pile of wood, cover it with dirt, light it on fire, but let only a little bit of air enter into it. And basically it would burn out all the impurities and leave behind charcoal, which is almost 100% pure carbon, which burns much hotter than wood does. And it's very clean, so it's not going to contaminate the metals that you're working with. With the power of charcoal, you could create copper, we could create bronze, and then eventually we created iron. Now, that's a major breakthrough. Iron requires a lot more work than bronze, because to melt iron, it has to get very hot. If you don't melt the iron, it's still full of a lot of impurities, which you have to beat out with a hammer. Just heating it, beating it, heating it, beating it, and then slowly that'll get all the sludge out of it, and then you're left with pure iron. If you melt the iron, it has the problem that it sucks up carbon from the charcoal that you're heating it in, and then it's not very useful either. Iron with a lot of charcoal in it is called pig iron, and you can make a cast iron pan out of it. But if you took a cast iron pan to a blacksmith, and they heat it up, they get it hot in the fire, and they start hammering it to sort of bend it into a new shape, it'll just crack. So there's a very specific amount of carbon that you need to have in your iron to make steel, and doing that is a lot of work. But there's so much iron in the crust that today, we use steel and iron. We don't really use a lot of bronze except for, door hinges and doorknobs and that kind of thing. It's, iron's really taken over. And so that required a much greater level of industrial sophistication because of the number of different processes involved. And then using chemical changes. So around the time of the Civil War, around the time of Mendeleev, which we can talk about chemistry too, Bessemer and the introduction of, forcing forcing air into the molten iron, transforming it, all the processes involved in creating steel, and then steel alloys, like stainless steel, which was invented in the 1910s. We've got materials now. Stainless steel doesn't exist anywhere in nature. Steel doesn't exist in nature. Stainless steel certainly doesn't exist in nature. So we're able to make these new materials that don't rust, that don't corrode the way that steel does. I mean, it's tremendous advancements. And then today, you know, the new kinds of metals that have, you know, that we use for electromagnetic reasons. So it's been a real development. Mm-hmm.
So how does that get us to this domain of chemistry?
Well, chemistry was, you know, in terms of where did chemistry come from? We had, you know, there was alchemy being done in the Middle Ages. People were trying to make gold, you know. Talk about trying to make money. You know, that's, they were trying to make money. But gold, it really isn't that useful industrially. We use it for some things, but it's not, you know, it's, you're not going to like build a, if we had all the gold we wanted, it wouldn't help you build a taller skyscraper.
Right.
Gold's soft, you know, it wouldn't be any good for that. The real big, huge, major breakthroughs were by Lavoisier and Mendeleev. So Lavoisier's major advance was to realize that there was something about matter. The amount of material didn't change when it underwent chemical processes. So part of that was Lavoisier's, now think about how hard this is. How do you measure how much gas a chemical reaction produces? When you burn wood in air, it sucks up some of the air and it makes carbon dioxide. How are you going to measure the weight of that carbon dioxide? It's really hard to weigh a gas. Lavoisier, you know, he made the apparatus to do it, which is what let him, you know, prove without a doubt that in these changes, the amount of material wasn't changing. The conservation of matter, we would call it today. And also, the conservation of the quality of that matter. That although these changes occurred, there was something that wouldn't change. And those were what he called the elements. That there was something basic about materials that no matter what you did to it, it would still maintain that quality. It would still be carbon. It would still be iron. And that's what made it an element. It had something about it that didn't change.
So the elements are not things you just find in the crust and they sort of self-identify themselves as elements.
No, a lot of what people thought were elements weren't. Some of them they were right about. I mean, you know, the, you know, people knew like sulfur and gold, you know, and copper for a long time, and those are elements. But other ones weren't. You know, air was considered to be an element. Lavoisier showed for sure that air was made up of more than one thing. There were different gases in the air. You know, he separated and distinguished oxygen and nitrogen. Mm-hmm. What Mendeleev did was he looked at these characteristics of what had been separated out as the elements. He noticed patterns or families of very similarly acting elements. And he used the first, almost everything about an element isn't physical. Let me say what I mean by that. Like if you take carbon, for example, carbon can form a diamond. Carbon can form charcoal. Carbon can form graphite. Those three things are very, very different.
Yeah.
They're all just carbon. So if you said, what color is carbon? You say, well, what kind? Can't answer you. You said, well, does carbon conduct electricity? Say, well, graphite kind of does, but a diamond doesn't, so I don't know how to answer you. Say, well, how much heat does carbon hold? Well, I can't really tell you. You know, basically any physical characteristic, carbon doesn't have them. Carbon has an opportunity to form those different compounds, you know, with other carbon atoms or with oxygen. Carbon and oxygen makes carbon dioxide, which is a gas. Carbon dioxide gas, it's not made out of coal. There's no coal in it. There's no diamond in it.
Contrary to what the greenies keep telling us.
Right, there's carbon in it. So between this distinction of the elements being what actions they can perform rather than their physical characteristics and the one thing that was the only physical characteristic, which was atomic weight, by looking at ordering the elements by their atomic weights and then also looking at these characteristic actions that they would have in common, Mendeleev noticed that there was something about all of matter that was periodic, that as the atomic weight went up, it would return to earlier characteristics. So if you look at a periodic table today, which people just get shown and they don't know where it came from, each row in it acts like the one above. It's a periodic ordering of the elements, which Mendeleev, of course, then had to be thinking, well, what does this say about what's underlying all of matter? What's the one thing that's true about chemistry if this if we get this periodic repeating of chemical characteristics. And that, you know, that gets into the nuclear age, which, you know, he didn't live long enough to, well, he couldn't have lived that long to see where that went.
But his protege, Vladimir Vernadsky, did live that long and was the founder of the Russian nuclear energy program. But this touches on something very important, which we've been discussing all throughout this show, which is these things that people think of as sort of self-evident ideas, like matter and carbon, or substance and element and compound and so forth, really are ideas. They're not you know, things you bump into and find on the earth.
Not at all.
Even the word element refers to a concept of it's a property of mind which you're bringing into existence, the idea of an element. Because in nature, the elements are all sort of mixed together with compounds, except for, I guess, the noble gases, which tend not to combine, and we don't have too many of them on. They're
right.
Pretty rare, right?
Yeah, no, it is. It's all a power of the mind. I mean, if you look at the power of separating the elements to even figure out what they ended up being, well, that required discoveries. I mean, none of this stuff is just around. You don't run into the elements in native states just sitting around in nature. You wouldn't be able to think about them just by observing them. This is definitely all the power of the mind.
So we really do a disservice in the educational system to hang that periodic table in every chemistry classroom and sort of get people to memorize the rows and the columns of it.
Yeah, it's sort of a crime. I mean, you know, the way it gets explained now is it's electron shells. Which, okay, I mean, maybe there's something, you know, there's something to that, but you
know. But there's an actual experimental basis for this, when you say electron even, what do you mean? You mean an idea,
right,
which we've come to think about based on some experimental evidence
right.
that we perform.
Right, they're all discoveries. They're not, so if you, whenever you start by saying, okay, elements are made out of protons and neutrons, and well, where did that come from? It really puts the cart before the horse. You start with these, like the most, you know, the most recent discoveries about things, and then you build up the past from that, and then what you lose is, if we knew everything that would ever be discovered, that would be okay, but we don't. And how are you going to get students to make new discoveries in the future if you don't go through how the ones in the past were made?
It actually brings up what you were saying about you have to want to create a new state, because, in fact, all these ideas like elements and electrons and neutrons and so forth are ideas which we have to create in order to comprehend things that we encounter when we're trying to bring about a new state.
Right. Yeah, we shouldn't forget that. Yeah, the words that we use are like we're looking at concepts that we're using, not necessarily. It's not exactly just looking at what's out there. So I mean, like electricity. Electron is the Greek word for amber. Rub amber and things will stick to it. That's the birth of electricity. So, you know, going from rubbing things to make electricity to the discovery that there are two different kinds of rubbed electricity. Resinous electricity from rubbing amber, vitreous electricity from rubbing glass, realizing that they were the same kind of electricity, just an absence or presence of it. Benjamin Franklin calling it positive and negative electricity. You know, we would have wished today he picked the opposite words, but anyway. That, you know, then having chemical electricity with a battery, you have flowing, moving electricity. Then with the connection between electricity and magnetism, we can create electricity not by rubbing something, not with a chemical reaction, but by moving a magnetic field around. I mean, our understanding of that whole field's so transformed that today it's astonishing that most of the energy use in the United States is, you know, comes through electricity as opposed to, you know, just burning something in your car engine. Imagine telling that to, you know, someone in Greece 3,000 years ago. That the funny thing they're discovering from rubbing amber and having, you know, hair stick to it would one day be the principle that supported half of all activity in the world's economy.
Right, and all these ideas arise out of a drive of mankind to actually bring about new states which didn't previously exist. All these things you just described, rubbing amber and moving electricity and chemical electricity and all these new states of matter are are things we give words to, but the words arise out of a out of something we actually created in our minds and want it to bring into existence.
Right, yeah. A motor doesn't exist in nature. Right. Or a generator. You don't find that coming out of a volcano.
So we just have a couple minutes left, and this gets us really to the back to where actually we have only a little less than a minute left. So it's amazing how fast these times go when you're discussing these things. But obviously, this really gets us to the point that we began with, which is, you know, what kind of world are we going to live in, right? If we're faced here with the potential, LaRouche has said that, you know, the rate at which this confrontation with Russia is occurring could get us into a nuclear confrontation over the next few weeks or 10 days or so. And on the other hand, you have this incredibly optimistic future that you and I have been discussing. So I guess since we're running out of time, we don't have we can't really get into that. So we'll have to bring you back and say that it obviously it's easy to conclude from this discussion that it, we better get Obama out of office, throw that bum out by March 1st, and then we can proceed to get moving with all these great things that are in this report. So thank you very much, Jason, for joining me today on this version of the LaRouche Show. And let me just say to all our listeners out there that this report is really something you want to read and study, and you should, when it'll be ready in the next few days, go to the LaRouche EIR website, LaRouchePub.com, and there'll be a link to it. And this is really something that people want to see, and it's a great gift to mankind. So thank you very much, Jason, for being with us today.
Thanks, Bruce.